Our speakers, I'm going to be introducing Dr. Bill Sook. He is the director of the NIEHS Superfund Research Program and also my supervisor, so be nice to him. And he's ready to give some introductory remarks. So Bill, please take it away.
Thank you, Danielle. I appreciate it. Here's the slides. Okay, cool. So first of all, I want to thank you all for the audience for joining us today. Because the Superfund Research Program may be new to some of our audience members, I just wanted to give you some context for our program. The Superfund Research Program was founded as part of the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act, otherwise known as SARA, in 1986. The SARA legislation created a university-based research program to address the wider range of scientific uncertainties facing the National Superfund program. What you see before you in this slide are four mandates. Advanced techniques for the detection, assessment, and evaluation of the effects on human health of hazardous substances, methods to assess the risks to human health presented by hazardous substances, methods and technologies to detect hazardous substances in the environment, and the number four, which is very unique to NIH, of which NIEHS is a part of, basic biological, chemical, and physical methods to reduce the amount and toxicity of hazardous substances. Therefore, the complex problems related to sites impacted by hazardous substances require the expertise of multiple biomedical and environmental science and engineering disciplines. The SARA legislation assigned this grant program, now known as the SRP, to the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences. NIEHS is one of 27 institutes and centers of the National Institutes of Health. So our mission is rooted in that of the National Institute of Health, which is to support and conduct research to understand how fundamental knowledge can be used to address positive outcomes. Next slide, please. In accordance with the mandates, the Superfund Research Program supports several funding mechanisms, which we have listed here today. Today, we will focus on grants funded through the P42 Multi-Project Centers Program, which are designed to integrate across disciplines, biomedical, environmental sciences and engineering, data management and analysis, community engagement, research translation, and important. The full title for the Superfund Research Program is the Superfund Hazardous Substances Basic Research and Training Program. It is unique in that it combines research and training under a single mechanism. Next slide, please. Excuse me. So I like to show this diagram because it emphasizes the importance of the interaction between the sciences to solve the complex problems associated with hazardous substances in the environment. And through interaction with Superfund stakeholders and impacted communities, the SRP centers are problem-based, solution-oriented research centers. They bring innovative science from a variety of disciplines to improve health and the management of hazardous substances in the environment. We feel interactions with a wide variety of stakeholders is critical, and this is part of the reason we started this Progress in Research webinar series. Next slide, please. Thank you. The SRP Progress in Research webinars feature work being initiated by recently awarded grantees. The purpose of these webinars is to facilitate a dialogue between the researchers, field practitioners, and stakeholders early in the stages of research progress so that these new projects are on a trajectory for successful technology transfer and application by the end user. This Progress in Research webinar series highlights promising research from SRP centers awarded grants in 2020. These awards were made as part of the multi-project center grant, the P42 solicitation that was released in 2018. Today's webinar is the first four webinars, and we encourage you to attend all of them. They are listed here as to the dates and what their overall theme will be. So with that, I want to thank you for your attention, and I will now pass it off to Dr. Danielle Carlin, who will introduce today's webinar presentations and speakers. Thanks again, and stay safe.
Great. Thank you very much, Bill. So now it's my pleasure to introduce our speakers. So I'm going to introduce all the speakers before each center gives their talk. So we'll start with the Harvard University Superfund Research Program Superfund Center. So first we'll hear from Dr. Chen Liu, who is a professor of environmental genetics and physiology. He is the center director for the Harvard Superfund Center. His laboratory studies include molecular mechanisms underlying complex gene environmental interactions in multigenic human diseases such as asthma and neurodegeneration, focusing in part on the emerging role of extracellular vesicles in disease pathogenesis prevention and therapeutics. He also leads the project within their center that's titled EVMIRNAs in Cognitive Function Decline Associated with Early Life Metal Exposure. Then we're going to hear from Dr. Julie Zimmerman. She's a professor of Chemical and Environmental Engineering, Environment and Epidemiology. She leads one of the projects within the center titled Designing the Next Generation of Highly Selective Sorbent Materials for Remediation of Target Inorganic Contaminants in Aqueous Systems. Her research interests are application of green chemistry and green engineering principles to innovative design of products, processes, and systems, assessing benign alternative chemicals and materials, policy design and analysis for sustainability, particularly related to water use and corporate environmental behavior. She's also interested in developing water treatment technologies for developing communities. And then finally, we'll hear from Dr. Kathy James. She's an assistant professor of family medicine at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. She's co-director with Dr. Tamara James Todd for the Harvard Superfund Center Community Engagement Corps. And Dr. James is an epidemiologist and a specialist in environmental systems and the long-term health effects of cadmium, arsenic, and other metals. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Liu to get started.
Thank you, Danielle. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Hello? Oh, great. Thank you, Danielle. Hello, everyone. I'm Chen Lu from Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and I appreciate the opportunity to introduce our newly founded Superfund Research Center and MemCare today. I will do the introduction along with my colleague Julie Zimmerman from Yale, as well as Kathy James from University of Colorado. So our MemCare Superfund Research Center is focused on metals and metal mixtures and their impact on cognitive aging. There's some problem with the slide control. Seems like I did not touch anything, but there's my slide advancing. Okay, so our MemCare Superfund Research Center is focused on metals and metal mixtures and their impact on cognitive aging through remediation and exposure sources. And the mission of our center is to understand and mitigate the effects of exposure, particular early life exposure to matter and matter mixtures on late life cognitive health. Although our MemCare Center is housed administratively at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health in Boston, but our center is truly a multi-institutional center. We have investigators from many institutions, Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, Harvard School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, Boston Children's Hospital, investigators from Yale University, the School of Engineering and School of Environment, Arizona State University, University of Colorado, Center for Health, Work and Environment, as well as others such as McLean Hospital, Fauci Institute, Dartmouth, and the Radiation and Public Health Project. So the central problem that our center is addressing is this one, how exposure during early critical windows of life to matters and matter mixtures affect cognitive function when we're getting old, the cognitive aging process. So we designed four projects to address, to tackle this problem. Two biomedical projects. In project one is the human epidemiology studies. Project two is the in vitro and in vivo mechanistic studies address the biological mechanisms underlying this this link. And then we have two environmental and environmental sciences projects, project three and four. In one, we will look at the sources where the matter contamination coming from in the U.S. water system. Project four is going to provide remediation, a novel remediation techniques to decontaminate water, matters in water. So, and the goal of this project is to provide solutions to these important public health problems. For example, project one will provide the tooth and toenail biomarkers, and project two is going to elucidate the disease mechanisms underlying this important connection between the matter and matter mixture exposures in early life and cognitive function. Project three is going to identify the sources of exposure of this contamination. And project four, as I mentioned, will provide the normal remediation techniques and methods to actually purify the water system. Our center is, these four projects are supported by four cores, obviously the admin core, which also include the research translation activities. We have a data management and analysis core, the DMAC core. We have a research experience and training core, and the project is supported by the community engagement core, which have two sites, one in Roxbury, Massachusetts, the other is St. Louis Valley in Colorado. So I'm going to introduce both project one and two. So in project one, this is a project led by Mark Weisskopf and David Krishani, both are in Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. So in this one, this is a human epidemiology study looking at the early life matter exposure and late life cognitive function. So the current knowledge in the field is that it's known that in utero and early life matter exposure are associated with impaired neurodevelopment. And it's also known that late life matter exposure associated with worse cognitive function. But it's not, in the animal models, it has shown that this in utero early life exposure to, in this case, particularly the lead exposure, has been shown to relate to late life Alzheimer's disease or other Alzheimer's-like neural in pathologies in animal models, but there's no human data to support this. And the animal studies, the data have supported this hypothesis called DOHAD, the development origins of health and disease. And this just showed that this is a hypothesis where early life exposures would impact the late life cognitive function, in this case, neurodegenerative conditions. So the aim of project one is to assess the association of in utero and other early life exposure to matter mixtures with worsening cognitive function in late life. And then also to assess, to identify novel biomarkers, in this case, extracellular microRNAs. These are small SNPs of RNA molecules that are stable in the circulation that you can identify. And to identify this, identify the associations with matters and with the cognitive function. So the project will use baby teeth as a biomarker. So baby teeth develop both pre and postnatally. So with identified timing, and there's techniques actually you can measure the matter contamination in the teeth, therefore to reconstruct the exposure history. And this will take advantage of this so-called St. Louis baby teeth study, SLBT study, in which children born in the 1950s, they donated their baby teeth and have been cataloged very nicely. And now these participants are about 70 years old, and it's so we're in the process of recontacting many of them to assess cognitive function and other aspects of life and health. So this is an overview of the project one. So this just show that on the right, it shows the picture of the scanning EM picture of the baby teeth. And you can actually, doing this technique called ICP-MS, you can measure the matter amount in these baby teeth and reconstruct their exposure history. So project two, again, is a biomedical project. This is co-led by myself and my colleague, Takao Hensh, who is a professor of neurobiology at Boston Children's Hospital. So in this case, we're looking at these extracellular vesicles. Many of you probably heard about extracellular vesicles, or simply known as EVs. The classic one called exosomes. And those extracellular vesicles are the small, tiny vesicles that are secreted by almost all human cells tested so far. And this has many studies have shown they can function both as a communicator between cells, so sort of intercellular communication, but also they can serve as a biomarkers because they are relatively stable, and the content inside, in this case, microRNAs, these small RNA molecules, they're very stable, can be measured reliably. So our goal of this project is to establish this extracellular vesicle or EV microRNAs as a novel biomarker by working with Project One and as the biomarker for memory exposure related to cognitive function. But they're also very important to establish the role of these microRNAs as a mechanistic basis for matter-induced neurotoxicity and cognitive impairment. The main hypothesis is that matter exposure in early life will alter the EV microRNA content in the brain, and that these changes, these alterations in EV microRNA would affect the function of neurons and neural stem cells to accelerate cognitive aging. This project has three specific aims. In aim one, this is we use this very innovative technique called 3D brain organoid. So as you know, it's very hard to study brain function in vivo. And in this the past few years, I've seen the development, really breathtaking development in this brain organoid model in which they can grow this neural cells into this 3D brain structure. They actually look they have the many features of brain, obviously, and not as complex as the real brain, but they can have many connections, interneuron connections, the connection between astrocytes and neurons, so synapses forming, so really innovative techniques that can use by research to study the brain function. So we're going to take advantage of this, and we're going to expose the 3D brain organoid to different matters, matter mixtures. Then we're going to look at the secretion of these extracellular vesicles and the microRNAs from these brain organoids. And then we are going to functionally analyze the brain organoid, looking at the cell population in this brain organoid to see whether they are altered by the exposure to the matter mixtures. In AIM-2, this is use the mouse model to study. So here we were going to expose the pregnant female mice during the pregnancy to in matter to different matters, and then we're going to follow these animals over the period of about 2 years. So therefore, 2 years is pretty old mice. And then we are going to look at assess the cognitive function in these animals, as well as we're going to collect blood and EVs and isolate, look at the EV microRNAs by doing the RNA sequencing. In the AIM-3, what we're going to do is that we're going to determine the functional role to see, because here in AIM-2, in AIM-1, we're going to identify this as potential biomarkers. In AIM-2, we're going to look at to see whether this can be functional in modifying the functions of neural cells and cognitive function in both mice and in brain organoid models. So now I'm going to hand the presentation to my colleague, Julie Zimmerman from Yale, to introduce Project 3 and 4. Julie?
Yeah, great. Thank you. So to complement all of the great work that's going on the biological side are two engineering projects. Project 3 is focused on helping us figure out where metals are occurring in drinking water and what system conditions correlate to the presence of which metals are there. So this project is a lot of using big data and trying to think through correlations between source water and groundwater conditions and soil conditions and matching that to what is actually in drinking water in terms of the metals and potential exposures for human health. So Project 3 has made some good progress on their research objectives, so identifying a comprehensive data set both on private wells as well as public water supply, and thinking about both the sources and fate and transport of these heavy metals through these water source systems, and then focused on developing and testing different statistical models to correlate the exposure of things like arsenic and lead and cadmium. We have a long list of metals and also co-occurring oxyanions that may interfere with trying to remove these metals from the drinking water because they compete for sorption sites or for some of our oxidative potential. And then, again, with Project 4, which I'll talk about in a minute, about our technology development is to really predict the performance of our technologies or different treatment trains to remove these metals from water. So just some quick results from Project 3 so far. So again, looking at arsenic, lead, and cadmium. And I should mention this project's being led by Dr. Elsie Sutherland at Harvard. So they were able to get data looking at private wells and current metal contamination in those different private wells. So you can see the spatial distribution across the U.S. of observed arsenic concentrations on the top, and then predicted arsenic concentrations. So their model is working fairly well already and will certainly be improved over the time of the grant, and then we'll add more and more metals and competing oxoanions to this. And you can see some of the variables that they're using to be able to predict these arsenic levels in the drinking water. So everything from the date at which the sample was taken to how much arsenic is present in the soil, and then point sources that might be located around the facility, and then things about groundwater recharge. So looking at all these variables, we can start to understand what metals might be present in the drinking water in terms of human exposure without taking environmental samples, but building out these models using big data and data science. So again, just a little bit more results here. This is showing observed and predicted groundwater concentrations for arsenic, lead, and cadmium. And you can see, again, already just in the 6 months since the grant has started, their model is working fairly well at this point. And Elsie's team is working really hard to reduce the amount of scatter by bringing in other variables and using some more advanced statistical techniques. Complementary to Project 3 is Project 4, which is a project I lead along with Dr. Chris Muhick and Dr. Paul Westerhoff at Arizona State University. And this project is focused on designing and developing new adsorbent materials to remove the metals that are present in the water. So Project 3 and Project 4 are quite well integrated because we want to design technologies that are specific to the metals that are present in different drinking water sources. So this is the idea of not building a one-size-fits-all treatment process, but a really tailored process for the particular water source that we're trying to treat. So again, we have three aims also in Project 4. One is synthesizing and characterizing some new novel material platforms. These are really bottom-up designs, either using waste biopolymers and doing some derivatization chemistry to those polymers to make them selective for certain metals. And then we also have another platform we're looking at using crystal facet engineering to design and tailor nanomaterials with surfaces that would be quite selective and specific for certain metals. And so in this way, we can increase our resource efficiency of only using sorbents for the metals we're interested in going after. And you can imagine building out a system that has layers or Lego bricks of different materials that are targeted for the metals that we know will be present in those wells or drinking water sources based on the models that are coming out of Project 3. So we have designed and synthesized and characterized some of these materials, and then we're working with Paul and Chris's groups to do some modeling. Chris is really focused on molecular modeling, so using density functional theory to predict which metals will sorb to these materials and how selective they will be. So there's a lot of back and forth from the model to the lab in terms of designing those surfaces, validating the model, and then using the model to actually predict performance of materials before we synthesize them. And then at a higher level scale is working with Paul Westerhoff's group to really think about how these materials would perform in an actual device, so whether that's a column and what flow rates, what retention times, and what size those columns need to be, and so looking more at macro modeling. And so far we're able to show that we can be quite selective with these biopolymers to pick out one of the main competition pairs, arsenic and phosphate. They look quite similar from a chemical structure and physical chemical property perspective. And so to have a material now that's actually selective for arsenic and arsenic 3, which we know is more toxic and harder to remove in the presence of phosphate. So that's the graph on the left. And on the right is some of the DFT modeling results about why that material is working the way it's working. So we can use that information to further optimize our selectivity and design for other metals beyond arsenic. And then platform two is this crystal facet engineering work. And so we've been really focused on what are the different crystal facets. We just submitted a literature review of everything that's known about nanometal oxides and the different facets and their preference for different metals. So there was a lot of literature out there to summarize and synthesize and then work again back and forth with the DFT model to really tailor design different facets to prefer certain metals that are present in the drinking water sources. And I'll turn it back over for the cores. I don't know if that's Tran or Kathy who's picking it up.
Kathy.
Yeah. Hi there. Thank you, Julie. I will be speaking about our cores and most specifically our data management and analysis core and our community engagement cores. And the data management and analysis core, which is led by Dr. Brent Kuhl and Dr. Zhang Lin, the aims are, you know, in general, to improve to have the state-of-the-art data management using sound and established statistical methods combined with emerging science in statistics and computational science, focusing on training the next generation of researchers and disseminating the methodological developments through manuscripts, case studies, web-based software, and also providing the training and the education to our trainees, students, and researchers. Our data will have a wide breadth of contributions from omics data, imaging data. We'll have biomarker and environmental samples data, and also incorporating spatial data related to residential location. These will also be used in simulations and output from those. Additionally, we'll be including some data sharing strategies, including submissions of the omics data to DDGAP, also NIH Data Commons when it's appropriate, and use of an open science web portals in conjunction with the Harvard Dataverse. Additionally, the use of free and open source software packages such as Dagaus that are based on containerization and executable programs that contain all the code. Also using bioinformatics, geographic information systems and technologies, and computational modeling. And our community engagement core, led by myself and Dr. Tamara James Todd at Harvard, involves two sites that are relatively similar in the fact that they are addressing and working with vulnerable populations However, also have some differences. So the first is the Demont Center, which is based in Massachusetts and overseen by Dr. James Todd at Harvard, is an urban partner. Contamination is mostly in the soil and in the air pollution, with the potential for water contamination due to older housing and infrastructure. And then our second location is in the San Luis Valley in Colorado, which is overseen by myself. And this is a rural partner with a heavy mining community and has a long history of water contamination due to mining activity, but then also due to naturally occurring metals from the bedrock that is present in the aquifer. There is also some level of soil contamination which can be aerosolized to make it into air exposure. The objectives currently, given COVID circumstances, is one, we're building our online presence in promotion of not just the research topic, but then also our engagement with the community and specifics to the study. And so this includes social media, website advertising with our community partners. We've also utilized local newspaper and radio, especially in our rural community. We have hard copies of community flyers and project information. We've utilized modern sources, including Facebook, YouTube channel, and Twitter. And we do have biannual webinars for mass viewing that are recorded that will be incorporated into our community engagement. This will replace some of our town halls that we'd originally proposed. And we do have a Q&A location, both on Facebook and then on other, through our connections through other social media as a way for the community to connect to the project. We're also going to be looking at incorporating online focus groups, specifically targeting pregnant women, which is our most vulnerable population within these communities. The second objective of the community engagement core is to recruit pregnant women and or their children from the communities that we are following. And this is a citizen science-based recruitment. And ideally, we're working with local clinics, one in Dimock and then two that are located in the San Luis Valley, who will recruit pregnant women. And we have established methods that are operationalized within the environment of COVID to allow participants to do online consents and interviews. We will be shipping sample kits to them along with instruction guides for collection of urine, soil, samples, and then also hair and nails samples if appropriate. And then we'll have local couriers able to pick up the sample kits from the participants, either contactless or you know, with contact based on the participant's preference. These collections are going to take place over several time points, during a couple of time points during the pregnancy and then during follow-up. And it's within that pregnancy era that when we identify a household that does have elevated levels of metals within the water, that's when we're going to bring in our third objective, which is then evaluating interventions for mitigation of exposure, where we will provide all households within our study that have elevated levels of metals with a current approved water treatment system for the removal of metals, and use as not only just the water treatment facility operation as a way of mitigating exposure, but then also incorporating community-based improvement of environmental literacy surrounding metals exposure, those critical exposure periods being in utero and early periods of time in life, and how to reduce those exposures and then informing them on those long-term health outcomes. And as a closure to our presentation, we'd like to thank Dr. Bill Sook and Danielle Carlin and all of the others with the Superfund Research Program for their continued guidance and advice. And we've provided our contact information for any questions that you might have after this presentation today. And thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Chen, Julie, and Kathy. That was a very wonderful overview of your center, and we look forward to the many great things you'll be doing over the next few years. I just want to remind our audience to please put in your questions into the Q&A pod. We did receive one question so far, and I think this would probably be best maybe addressed by Julie. How can you make preliminary conclusions about the efficacy of the filters when the MGL for arsenic is 4 ppm? That's nearly three orders of magnitude greater than the arsenic MCL of 10 micrograms per liter, or 0.01 milligrams per liter, or 0.01 ppm.
Yeah, that's a great question and good eye. So the data I presented there was at pretty high concentrations because we're running those samples at the synchrotron at Brookhaven National Lab to look at binding mechanisms so that Chris can do the DFT modeling. And so we want a lot of arsenic on the surface of those materials. But in the papers we have published in the past and going forward, obviously most relevant to reducing the health effects from these exposures is we are able to come into compliance with the current drinking water standard, both for WHO as well as for the U.S. And so we're able to meet that MCL, even though the data I showed was not for that set of experiments.
Okay, great. And then while we're still waiting for those to put in their questions into the Q&A pod, I guess a follow-up question, though, to you, Julie, is I'm always trying to picture these technologies, and so I'm curious, the technology you're developing, is that for a very large water filtration systems, for example, like for cities or municipalities, or are they more for, like, home-use type of filtration systems?
Yeah, these are more kind of home use under the sink, kind of where you'd usually find a reverse osmosis system, and small community scale systems, so a system that would serve 500 people or less, is where we think there's a target here. Those are systems that tend to be most out of compliance on metals, and particularly arsenic, because of the cost. And so we think that's where the niche market is of developing a technology that could be commercialized and compete in the marketplace is at those smaller scales.
Okay, well, thank you. And again, I'm encouraging our audience to please submit those questions. So I guess I have a question then for Chen, since he's on the line. I have two questions. One is, the first, you use the term cognitive aging, and I was just curious as to why you don't use maybe other language such as dementia or Alzheimer's, or is that kind of what you end up hoping to find through the study with you and Mark?
Yeah, I think that Mark probably can answer this. I can provide some overview, but is Mark online? Yeah, so in Mark's epidemiology study design, I think we were looking at the cognitive, because he's going to send out questionnaires. So it's not, because we are not in position to diagnose the in dementia, so that's why I called, you know, cognitive function, so more general, covering the potentially cover the in dementia, but not specifically, you know, diagnose this patient with dementia.
Okay, and then I was just curious too, and again, maybe Mark is the best person to answer this question, but do you know anything about the potential exposures to those from the St. Louis study?
Yeah, I can say a few. So they were exposed. So right now, because Mark already looked at the began to look at the T samples. As I said, he used the ICP-MS method. He can look at the matter exposure. So they're definitely you know, matter exposure. But how high, how prevalent, we don't know yet. But those studies, I believe, originally was designed, the baby teeth were collected for the radiation studies. So, now we're using that same cohort for this in matter mixture studies.
Okay, well, thanks. And so we're getting some more questions coming in. So this is back to Julie again. So for the filtration systems, what are plans for filter maintenance? Do breakthrough levels vary across regions? For example, and water harvest, pH, et cetera.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the reason we're interested in making these materials really selective is that breakthrough can be dependent, right? If we have lots of background phosphate or silica in the water, it will use up the sorption spaces, and so you'll have breakthrough of the metals of concern for human health much sooner than you would otherwise if you were able to target or select. And so we're really focused on being quite selective and then building out a layered system so that you could remove just arsenic, for example, in the top layer, and then maybe selenate or chromium in the next layer, and then lead. So we're really focused on that. We're also doing some additional chemistry as we're derivatizing the biopolymers to add some fluorescent or other sensor-like detection technology, and so you would actually be able to physically look at the filter and see a change visually as the different layers are being filled up. And then again, instead of having to throw out the entire content of the filter, it's just replace the layer that is being used up at that point for the metal that you're interested in. And so it would make it quite modular, which we think from sustainability perspective has a much better economic play than dumping all of this material, which may or may not be used up for the metals you're interested in, and maybe for things that are much more background and not of concern for human health.
Okay, well, thank you. And then the person that asked the question also thanks you. Dr. Mark Weisskopf, who's the project lead for the first project, he did say, yes, there have been some studies of lead, for example, in the teeth of the St. Louis baby teeth subjects. So thank you, Mark, for replying to that. I think I also have then a question for Kathy. So I'm just curious about the Colorado cohort. I seem to have heard that maybe there was some additional, maybe you could tell us a little more about additional metals exposures due to a recent flooding event. And I just want to be sure I have that correct, that it was due to some like ice, that there was a large ice melt. And maybe are you looking at all into that potential exposure?
Oh, that's a great question. So they're referring to the Gold King mine spill, which was actually on the other side of the San Juan mountain range from where the San Luis Valley community is. So that was on the western side and definitely had some great impacts on the ecology on that western slope. And, you know, fish kills, you know, and deposition of metals into the sediment of the rivers. On my side of the, and I shouldn't say mine, on my community side of the San Juan, which is the eastern side, there has been a flooding event in one of the locations outside of, you know, located on the right in the San Juans. It's a former mining area. And this was less due to a shift, as mentioned, with the Gold King mine. This was more related to a flooding event due to alterations in temperature. And so typically with the snowpack that we have, we usually have this longer spring period for gradual melting. And we had a very hard freeze and then a really, really fast melt. And so that led to a spill event that and it wasn't a spill, it was more of a flooding event. And it's because of the way the water system, the mitigation systems, environmental ones that are employed at this former mining site were designed less so for some of these flooding events perpetuated by fast melting snowpack. And so we're actively working right now with the community to bring together all of their environmental data and from all sources. We have the mining operators that are operating the current mine, EPA, USGS, and local, ecotourism groups that have been collecting water data and soil data, and we're bringing this all together into a large database that will be publicly accessible and available online for the whole community, where they can look at the historical metal content. And we're looking at all metals that have been monitored, targeting some of the more heavy ones associated with mine, but we're also going to be targeting those that are also naturally occurring and also prevalent in the community.
Great, thanks. I'm amazed at how hard that community's been hit by these various exposures. So I think the next, we do have 1 minute left, so let me just go and ask this final question that came in. And I think this goes for not just the metal that they're asking about, but the person is asking, how would you control for identifying different sources of, in this case, you're saying lead exposure, such as lead in gasoline, compared to lead in drinking water? So probably the same goes maybe for the other metals as well. Like, for example, do you get them through food or through water, et cetera? So how will you differentiate where these exposures might be coming from?
I don't know if you can hear me. This is Mark Weiskopf.
Oh, hi, Mark. Yes,
Hi. So this may be a different question for different parts of the project, but certainly for Project One, when we're looking in teeth, that's a biomarker of exposure. So in essence, that does not distinguish from the source. That's basically, you know, a accumulation of everything that has gotten into the system. One can potentially do isotope differences with laser ablation, ICP-MS, to possibly get some indication of source. I'm not totally clear that could well define every source lead was coming from, and that's sort of another level we had not been initially planning, but it's potentially possible. But the main issue, the main point is that with the teeth, we're really looking at sort of all comers, the lead or any other metal from all different sources.
Great. Thank you so much. So in the interest of time, we do have to move on to our next speaker. So we all want to give you a virtual round of applause. So thank you very much from our Harvard group. So next, it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Rebecca Fry. She's the Center Director for the University of North Carolina Superfund Research Program Center. She's also the Director of the Institute for Environmental Health Solutions and the Carol Remmer Engel Distinguished Professor in Children's Environmental Health in the Department of Environmental Sciences and Engineering at UNC Chapel Hill. Her lab focuses on understanding how environmental exposures to toxic substances are associated with human disease, with a particular focus on genomic and epigenomic perturbations. Her labs use toxicogenomic and systems biology approaches to identify key molecular pathways that associate environmental exposure with diseases. The current focus of her lab is to study prenatal exposure to various environmental contaminants, including arsenic, cadmium, and perfluorinated chemicals. And Dr. Fry aims to understand molecular mechanisms by which such early exposures are associated with long-term health effects in humans. And ultimately, her lab aims to identify mechanisms of contaminant-induced disease and the basis for inter-individual disease susceptibility. So with that, Dr. Fry, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Danielle. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you for the opportunity to present on behalf of the UNC Superfund Research Program team. We're focusing our center on inorganic arsenic contamination through drinking water. We're concerned about arsenic. It's the number one priority contaminant of the ATSDR. It's a health hazard worldwide. It's a health hazard in the United States, and it's a health hazard in North Carolina, as you can see on this slide. In North Carolina, exposure to arsenic in drinking water can occur from a variety of different sources. It's naturally occurring, so part of what you see in this slide is the orange area in the central part of the state that's known as the Carolina Slate Belt. It can be tied to our existing Superfund sites. Those are highlighted in blue. And it can also be linked to coal-fired power plants and associated coal ash. Those are highlighted in black. And all of those exposure sources are concerned for more than 3 million individuals in North Carolina who are drinking from private drinking wells that are unregulated. And in terms of health effects, we know that arsenic is associated with cancer and other, but also non-cancer endpoints. And the focus for our center is on diabetes and more broadly metabolic dysfunction. And while there's lots of evidence that arsenic is a diabetogen, there are many gaps that remain in terms of understanding the mechanisms by which this happens. And so our team has come together to address these gaps and to identify novel methods to reduce exposure and identify mechanisms underlying arsenic-induced metabolic dysfunction. In terms of our structure, we have three biomedical projects. These focus on identifying biological mechanisms underlying arsenic-induced metabolic dysfunction. These are really highly translational and include the use of human cells, mouse models, and human populations, and focus on several different molecular drivers of disease, including circulating small RNAs, key transcription factors, and genes that we know play a role in metabolizing arsenic, as well as currently unidentified genes that likely influence arsenic-induced disease and diabetes. And the biomedical research projects are complemented by two environmental science projects that are focused on environmental monitoring and arsenic removal. And the projects are coupled with cores that support chemical analysis, data analysis, translation of research to key stakeholders, working with our communities of concern in North Carolina, and then training our next generation of environmental health scientists and engineers. We have three biomedical research projects, and these are focused on various target tissues that are relevant to metabolic dysfunction in the body, so the liver, the intestine, and the pancreas. In terms of what we know, arsenic can modify insulin signaling in the liver. It can decrease insulin secretion from the pancreas, and it can also influence metabolism by modifying the gut microbiome. But we really don't know how much of this happens, and so the biomedical research projects are focused on filling that research gap. In terms of our environmental science projects, they're focused on methods for prediction of arsenic in private wells in North Carolina, as well as co-occurring contaminants. So we know that individuals are likely not just exposed to inorganic, but there are co-occurring contaminants, and our environmental science projects are really well poised to address that, and also methods to remove arsenic from drinking water to improve public health. So I'll go on to describe highlights from each of our projects and cores, highlighting our really outstanding scientific team and their amazing mentees. Project one is led by Praveen Sethupathi and Merrick Stieblo and is supported by their team shown to the right. And they're looking at understanding how small RNAs, so RNAs less than 22 nucleotides in length, may actually be controllers of arsenic-induced diabetes. They're also focused on key transcription factors that may drive arsenic-induced disease and setting out to determine whether or not they can identify these RNAs as biomarkers. And just wanted to highlight a trainee from their project, Kieran Koch-Laskowski. And generally in this project, they're focusing on understanding the effects of arsenic on transcriptional regulation, focusing on cells that are relevant to diabetes and metabolic dysfunction. They're using a really innovative technology known as chromatin run-on sequencing, or CRO-seq, which has advantages above and beyond traditional RNA sequencing. It provides information on transcriptional activity, but also active promoters and active enhancers in the genome. So in terms of some of their studies that they've done so far, they're looking at pancreatic beta cells exposed to inorganic arsenic as well as its methylated metabolite. And then they perform this CRO-seq assay where they can identify the enrichment of these key transcription response elements and get a sense of whether or not specific transcription factors are tied to arsenic-induced metabolic dysfunction. So just some key take-homes from this project: inorganic arsenic and its metabolites they're seeing are differentially modifying transcriptional activity in pancreatic cells, and they're also identifying some key transcription factors as responders to arsenic and its methylated metabolites. I also wanted to highlight some really recent research coming out of our center, specifically through a collaboration between Bev Kohler in the Department of Genetics at UNC and Merrick Stieblo in the Department of Nutrition. Together, they have generated a humanized arsenic-3 methyltransferase mouse model that I anticipate will really change the way toxicologists are assessing arsenic toxicity. Here they've taken the mouse gene that encodes arsenic-3-methyltransferase, which is the gene known to metabolize inorganic arsenic, and they replace it with the orthologous human gene to reproduce human-like metabolism of arsenic. So in this slide, let me see if I can get that arrow. Not sure I can get that arrow, but there it is. So in this slide, you see this graphic here shows the representation of the metabolism of the humanized mice, showing all of the abundance of the inorganic, the monomethylated, and the dimethylated form. If you compare this to a standard mouse model, it would have a very different pattern of metabolism. And in fact, the humanized mouse now looks much more like the human in terms of metabolism. So really exciting, just published in EHP, and we're working on incorporating this mouse model throughout several of the other biomedical research projects. Our second biomedical project is led by Fernando Pardo Manuel de Viena in the Department of Genetics at UNC. He's supported by the team on the right. And in his project, he's focusing on interactions among arsenic exposure genotype for arsenic-3-methyltransferase, that gene I was just talking about, obesity, which we know is a driver on its own of diabetes, but here we're looking at the relationship between exposure to arsenic and diabetes as an interactive effect. And they're also focused on identifying molecular signatures of arsenic-associated diabetes. This project is really exciting. They're using the collaborative cross mouse strains. And here, the collaborative cross strains are genetically diverse and, in a way, mimic human population responses to arsenic. So some of the data that have come out of the lab recently highlight that if you look across 12 of these collaborative cross strains, they have differential expression of arsenic-3-methyltransferase in their livers. And so we often wonder, why is it that a population responds differentially to same levels of exposure to a contaminant? This is just one example of why that would happen, and again, mimics what you would see in a human population. On the right, you can see that the collaborative cross strains also display different levels of arsenic metabolism in their livers. So you have the blue inorganic arsenic, the orange monomethylated arsenicals, and the green, the dimethylated arsenicals. And the team so far is showing that this metabolism is in part driven by arsenic-3-methyltransferase, but also likely by other genes that are being pursued by the team. And so together, Project 2 is looking at these inter-individual differences in arsenic metabolism that can be studied using the collaborative cross strains, and the fact that genetics, in addition to arsenic-3-methyltransferase, but likely many other genes, influencing arsenic-induced diabetes. Our third biomedical project is shown here. It's led by Kun Liu. His team is shown on the right. And in Kun's project, they're focusing on how arsenic impacts the gut microbiome, the role of a receptor known as the farnesoid X receptor. That was strange. And identifying potential solutions for arsenic-associated diabetes using gut microbiome manipulation. Not sure why the slides just went back to the original, but okay. And some of their exciting data is shown here where they've taken mice, exposed them to arsenic, and they look at metabolomic profiling from fecal samples of those mice. You can see that they identify these 370 features, those that are green are more highly abundant in the arsenic-exposed mice. Those that are red are less abundant in the arsenic-exposed mice. And so this begins to provide some information on mechanisms of disease. They're also focusing on bile acids, such as lithocholic acid, cholic acid, and deoxycholic acid, and showing that they see a dose response decrease in these levels in relation to arsenic exposure on the right-hand side. And here they've looked in the liver, the small intestine, and in serum. And so together they're finding so far that arsenic impacts the gut microbiome. The gut microbiome can influence metabolism of arsenic. They're also showing this impact on bile acids in tissue and serum, which again are highlighting the impact of gut microbiome changes. Really complementing our biomedical research projects is the first of our environmental science projects. This is directed by Owen Duckworth at NC State, and his team is shown on the right. In Project 4, they're focusing on identifying geochemical factors that can influence arsenic levels, but also, again, co-occurring contaminants, described as vanadium and chromium in groundwater. And Owen and his team are asking whether land management can impact the levels of these contaminants and also work to identify methods to predict high levels of contaminants, in particular in drinking water wells. As I had described at the beginning, one of the major sources of concern for exposure for our population. And I apologize, I should have highlighted the trainees on the other slide, so let me do it here. Chelsea Obeidi, Fatai Balagun, Chris Bowers, Hannah Peel, all trainees contributing to Owen Duckworth and team's projects. And here they're, again, looking at biogeochemical factors that can influence arsenic and trying to understand, for example, does manganese oxide depletion affect arsenic solubility? And what is the impact of land development and management on nitrate and dissolved organic carbon, both of which can influence the solubility and levels of inorganic arsenic in private drinking wells. And so far, their preliminary data support that arsenic levels are influenced by these local land use factors that can enrich for nitrate and DOC fluxes to groundwater, and also that they can predict how much arsenic as well as co-occurring contaminants could be present using manganese oxide. And this will be really relevant to us and our work translating this to well construction in North Carolina. And I also wanted to highlight Owen Duckworth recently won the Jackson Soil Chemistry and Mineralogy Award for outstanding contributions in the area of soil chemistry and mineralogy. So congratulations, Owen. And moving on, our Project 5, our last project but not least, is led by Orlando Cornell, supported by his team on the right. And Orlando and team are working to identify membranes that could be used to effectively remove arsenic as well as co-occurring contaminants. They're working to identify sorbents that are most functional at removal and then demonstrating the use of these in point use systems. And together, the Cornell and Miller labs are working towards optimizing membranes that can be used for arsenic removal. They've shown some really interesting data so far that ion exchange polymer coatings that you can see on the left in figure B remove arsenic to a greater degree than the unmodified membranes. And they're also showing on the right-hand side of the figure that coating thickness enhances removal. So here, the 600 nanometer coating was much more successful at rejecting the solute than the 100. And so their recent data are highlighting that these membranes can be optimized for inorganic solute removal, and exciting for us as the membranes can offer a removal strategy in high-risk areas in North Carolina that obviously we'll be testing in the future. Just wanted to acknowledge both Casey Miller and Orlando Cornell recently received a computing award from the National Science Foundation related to their work on membranes. In terms of our cores, I run our administrative core. I couldn't do it without the support of those who are listed here. And you know, in addition to the oversight operation of the center, one of the areas that we really focus on is our research translation. So working within our SRP, working with our sister SRP centers, working to transfer technology and partnering with government agencies and making sure that the information that we're developing within the center is communicated to our end user stakeholders. Just as one example of our work that involves a collaboration with the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services, we've developed an online guide that helps well owners figure out the best well water treatment for different contaminants. So obviously working towards user-friendly, easy accessible material. Just wanted to highlight some of the trainees who are really working in this area of research translation, translatability of their research. Eric Brown is focusing on identifying relationships between locations of Superfund sites across the United States and different demographic variables. Leah Clark is focused on understanding the impact of arsenic exposure and the health of pregnant women. Lauren Eves is working, again, with the NCDHHS, as well as colleagues in Department of Epidemiology and Environmental Science to identify hotspots of concern for arsenic exposure in North Carolina. And Amari Gardner is working closely with our community engagement core to provide some translation of the research to communities at risk, which leads nicely into our community engagement core, which is led by Kathleen Gray, who's supported by Andrew George and Sarah Yelton in their work, working with North Carolina stakeholders, increasing the understanding of communities about high risk for exposure, obviously working to reduce these exposures, working to develop local and state policies to prevent and reduce arsenic exposure in private wells. And some examples of their work is that aims to provide key information to community partners and key stakeholders is shown here. One example is an assessment of perceptions that drive whether or not individuals will use or adopt point-of-use water filters. And so understanding those perceptions can influence, and hopefully we can help to modify those so that we can implement the utilization of these point-of-use water filters. The CEC is also co-leading a well water working group in the state with key stakeholders. Their aim there is to improve well testing and remediation of contaminated wells. Our core C is our data management and analysis core, our DMAC. It's run by Stan Aholt at RENC, Julia Rager in Environmental Sciences and Engineering, Fei Zhao in Biostatistics. And they're providing key analysis to support data sharing across the UNC SRP and also hopefully with our sister SRPs. and sophisticated analytics for lots of the large data sets that we're working with. You heard about some with the RNA sequencing. There's also DNA sequencing, exposomic analysis, and many, many more. So we really need them to help us integrate and bring the data together to make sense. And all of this information is aimed at, again, identifying novel mechanisms that underlie arsenic-induced metabolic dysfunction. The chemistry core is led by Kun Liu, supported by his team. This core is obviously essential to the assessment of arsenic and its metabolites, as well as co-occurring contaminants. And the core also works on understanding, for example, gut microbiome perturbations or metabolic disruption, highlighted by some of the slides that I showed you earlier on. And here's just an example of the types of analytics that are run through the chemistry core, where we'll assess for inorganic arsenic as well as its methylated metabolites, and its different speciated forms. And understanding the presence of arsenic as well as co-occurring contaminants is really important for us moving forward. Our research experience and training coordination core is led by Ilona Jaspers and Megan Rabouli. And just wanted to highlight that we were so pleased to have won the Karen Wetterhahn Award. Elizabeth Martin won the Karen Wetterhahn Award for the SRP recently. And our RATC is really focused on helping support our trainees, supporting their professional career, cross-training across biomedical and environmental sciences, supporting them to learn how to work with community-engaged research, and providing opportunities for them to work with the amazing researchers in the DMAC core and working with high sophisticated analytics. So I'll end on this slide and just say thank you so much to our trainees. They represent our future environmental health scientists and environmental engineers, and we're so grateful to the NIEHS for Superfund research program funding. And I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
Great. Thank you so much, Rebecca. That was a great overview. We have received a few questions. And again, I'm going to encourage our audience to please submit your questions through the Q&A pod. So this person says that they're particularly excited about the gut microbiome and your arsenic work. They're curious, what do you think is the impact of the bugs or the other niche bugs is of the metabolic byproducts?
Yeah, so this is really fascinating research, and I don't know if Kuhn is on and can type you something back in there, but his lab has shown that arsenic modifies the microbes, but also that the microbes modify arsenic, and so the microbes themselves can actually influence the types of the arsenic metabolites that are present in the gut. So there's this two-way crosstalk between arsenic exposure and what's happening in the gut that his team is really, really, pioneering a lot of the work in terms of understanding what's happening. So, yeah, thanks for that question.
Okay, that's very interesting. So then we now received a question that says, have you costed out the different private well treatment options in your RTC communications back to the communities?
Can you, Danielle, was that, have we costed?
Yeah, I think what they're saying is, have you, given them any estimates of how much it would cost to implement these treatments?
I see. So in terms, absolutely, it's one of the, very important features is that any sort of membrane that would be developed would be cost effective. We're not at that point yet for our center that we would be able to have those true estimates. In fact, Orlando is still in the process of developing the optimized membranes. That will absolutely be something that we're working with our communities on, and making sure that anything that we would want to deploy would be a cost effective solution. So definitely we'll be keeping our eyes on that.
Okay. And while we're still waiting for our audience to submit questions, I know I had a question, and I don't know if you can get to the granularity of this, but you know, you show the map of North Carolina, and we all, a lot of us in the audience live in North Carolina. Do you have then the data on those that have diabetes, or that you can make that link with the, and then knowing whether or not they live on private wells, and you know, are you able to really link the health data with that, or is that something that you're just trying to predict at this time, that those that may be more exposed to arsenic are going to have a higher chance of getting diabetes later down the road?
Yeah, so the evidence that supports that arsenic is a diabetogen is very, very strong. Those data haven't come out of North Carolina, I'd say in part because you know, that would be work that would be really interesting to come out of our SRP. But the work comes out of populations from all over the world, including the United States. The data is very, very strong and convincing that arsenic is a diabetogen and that there's an interaction, right, with genotype and diet and obesity. And so the biomedical project that we have will get at that interaction. I would say, Danielle, probably down the road, us working on, you know, do we identify an association between arsenic exposure and diabetes in North Carolina? Again, would be an interesting question, but from a very, very substantial literature of human populations around the world, it is well established. So we'd be interested in focusing on it down the road, but I don't think we need to do that. We know that there's an association there.
Okay, well, thank you. So the question came in, what interactions do you see between arsenic and diabetes in terms of timing of exposure?
We have some really exciting data. I had been hoping that I could figure out a way to put it into this presentation, but we just learned that our paper was accepted yesterday, where Merrick Stieblo and my team have been focusing on developmental exposure, but in fact focusing on preconception exposure, so exposure that's happening prior to pregnancy. This is obviously in mouse models, and we're showing that there's an association between that preconception exposure and diabetes risk. So again, there's a lot that is not known about, you know, when are these vulnerable windows when we could be exposed to arsenic and then have diabetes as an outcome, but the data are showing from our lab showing that preconception is a time that could be associated with diabetes later in life. And then from other human population studies, you know, chronic exposure has been linked to diabetes as well.
Okay, well, thank you. It looks like we got another question that's come in. Okay. Let's see what. Is this relationship through the microRNAs or other epigenetic mechanisms?
Yeah, so the relationship is going to be really complex, and that's the beauty of these programs is to have, you know, to be able to support the biomedical projects to try to get at that. That relationship is likely tied to microRNAs that change. It's likely tied to transcription factors that change, proteins that change, and in all of those different target tissues that we're studying. So the pancreas, the liver, and the gut, right? So the body's complex and all of those features are interacting with each other, but certainly influencing insulin secretion and insulin signaling in the body. And then we'll try to understand how all of those factors work together to influence arsenic-induced diabetes risk.
Okay, well, thank you. So I guess, and also in the interest of time, we probably should move on, but I do want to encourage if you have a question that you want to ask Rebecca or any of our other previous speakers, please still feel free to put them into the Q&A pod, and we'll see if there's some time afterwards for kind of an open discussion. So again, Rebecca, thank you so much. We're all applauding for you, and thank you for giving us that overview. Okay, so.
Thank you, Danielle. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye. Well, don't hang up, though, yet in case you have questions. So let's see. The next, our next three speakers, they come from University of Arizona Superfund Center. We'll start with Dr. Raina Mayer. She is the center director for their center. She is a professor within the Department of Environmental Sciences. And like I said, she's also the director of the U of A Superfund Research Program Center. Her interests are microbial ecology of stressed environments. That includes caves, deserts, and ducts, bioremediation and reclamation of mining sites, which includes phytostabilization of mine tailing, and biosurfactant discovery and characterization. She's also a project lead within her center, and her project is titled Importance of Capping Material Properties in Remediation of Mine Tailings. And then she'll be followed by Dr. Donna Jane, who is the Associate Director of the U of A Superfund Research Program Center. She is a professor of pharmacology and toxicology. And the key scientific questions from Dr. Jane's lab is addressing how the NRF2 signaling network regulated in response to diverse environmental cues. How does prolonged NRF response, the dark side, during chronic arsenic exposure lead to lung cancer and type 2 diabetes? And then how can we rationally design therapeutics regarding NRF2? And then finally, what are the overlapping distinct regulatory mechanisms, roles of NRF1, NRF2, and NRF3? And her Superfund Center project is titled Diabetogenic Mine Tailings: Mechanistic Link Between Arsenic, NRF2, Autophagy, and Diabetes. And last but not least, we'll hear from Dr. Monica Ramirez-Andriota, and she is an assistant professor at the U of A and a part of the U of A Superfund Center Research Translation. She's their Research Translation Coordinator. And her research interests include environmental contamination and soil and food quality and phytotechnologies to improve soil and air quality. And in parallel, she is building citizen science programs to increase public participation in environmental health research, developing low-cost environmental monitoring tools to improve exposure estimates, and designing effective risk communication and report-back strategies that will improve environmental health literacy. So I'll turn it over now to Dr. Mayer for the presentation.
Thank you, Danielle. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Great. Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. It really is a pleasure to be here, and I want to thank NIEHS for giving us this opportunity to talk about our center. My name, as Danielle has just introduced, is Raina Mayer, and I'm the director of the University of Arizona Superfund Research Center. Our center is an established one. We're in our 31st year, and we were renewed in April of this year to 2025. I am an environmental microbiologist by training, and I'm joined today in this presentation by Dr. Donna Zhang, who's our associate director and is a molecular toxicologist by training, and by Dr. Monica Ramirez-Andriada, who runs our research translation efforts and is an environmental scientist who specializes in sociology and environmental health. This first slide provides an overview of our center, which is entitled Exposures, Health Impacts, and Risks for Mine Waste Contamination. And we focus on arsenic as a contaminant, and thank you to Rebecca Fry for the great background on the need to study arsenic as a contaminant. And we also focus on diabetes as a health outcome. The context of our work really is the arid and semi-arid U.S. Southwest, and we focus on the legacy and ongoing contamination that comes out of the mining industry. We have 5 research projects, and we have 4 cores, and we'll briefly describe each one of these for you today. But first, I want to put our center into context for you, into the context of the disease we study, diabetes, and also of the climatic region in which we live. So I'm going to advance my slide here. There we go. First, why have we chosen diabetes? As you can see in this slide, the incidence of diabetes for both American Indians and Hispanics is much higher in the U.S. Southwest than it is in the United States as a whole. And we think that one of the reasons for this is that the rich ore deposits that we have in the Southwest that have made the Southwest a mecca for mining are also associated with high levels of arsenic in these ore deposits. And it's also known that both indigenous and Hispanic communities are disproportionately impacted by mining activities. In other words, they are the workers that have lived in the mines, and their communities are generally closer to the mines. This next slide perfectly illustrates the issue of dust in our climatic region. So we live in a semi-arid environment, and we really have an additional exposure route that a lot of you don't really think about most of the time, you from the Midwest and you from the East Coast. But this is an exposure route that is very important, and it's the inhalation of dusts generated in our region and the ingestion of these dusts that are transported from a contaminated site into the home. And if the CLUIN people could start this video now, that would be wonderful. Okay. So while we're waiting for this video to start, let me just talk about what you're looking at. You are looking at the surface.
Raina, we're able to see the video. At least I can.
What? Yeah. Oh, you're seeing it. Okay. Yeah, somehow mine is not showing it. Great. So you're seeing the video. This is the Iron King Mine and Humboldt Smelter Superfund site. And you can see the winds are blowing these dusts, and this happens generally every morning. The winds are predominantly in the direction of the dust generation that you're seeing in this video. And these dusts are blowing off the edge of the tailings. The tailings abut a highway, and across the highway is the town of Dewey Humboldt. Dewey Humboldt has already undergone 2 yard removals because of high levels of dust deposited from not only this part of the site, but also the now defunct smelter part of the site. These tailings are highly acidic, pH 2 to 3, and contain highly elevated levels of arsenic, lead, and zinc. So I want to put this also in the context of hard rock mining for you. This is not a single site. These sites are found all over the western U.S. because hard rock mining is mainly found in the western U.S. and in arid regions of the world. So we find this type of issue with dust generation of contaminants is not only a U.S. issue, but it's a global issue found in arid and semi-arid regions. All right. So given this context that I've now spoken about, I'd like to briefly introduce our 2 environmental projects. The first of these 2 projects seeks to examine site-specific arsenic speciation to provide guidance to help prioritize which sites should be remediated first. In other words, which are the most dangerous sites in terms of arsenic bioavailability. And the second of the projects seeks to provide guidance on cap and plant technology for the successful remediation of mine waste sites, which in effect then reduces exposure to arsenic. So Project 4 is entitled Environmental Controls on Bioavailability of Arsenic and Toxic Metals. And we're really interested in how climate weathers these tailings to change arsenic bioavailability. And to that end, we'll be collecting mine tailing samples from 11 or 12 sites across the U.S. West, and we'll be evaluating those materials. To look at pore scale changes in arsenic speciation. We will then be incorporating, my controls are a little bit funky here, we'll be incorporating the pore scale arsenic speciation into reactive transport models that can help us understand how arsenic moves in the environment and the toxicity imposed by arsenic on human systems. In Project 5, which is entitled The Importance of Capping Materials in Remediation of Mine Tailings, we are looking at working actually with mining companies to look at a variety of capping materials and examining the microbiome and geochemical properties of these capping materials as a function of their source, their age, and their depth. And as you can see in the picture on the right, this is a soil profile. We took four samples in this profile and looked at DNA biomass. And you can see at the surface, DNA biomass is normal and high, but it quickly declines to a very small amount as you go with depth into this material. And we anticipate that this means that there is a very compromised microbiome that will be less supportive of the revegetation process if you use that deeper material as a capping material. We would like to then correlate the properties of the microbiome and the geochemistry. As well, we will be looking at both locally adapted species and unadapted plant species and correlating their ability to grow in the tailings to plant germination and growth success. And this information will be generated in the greenhouse using these rhizotrons, which are two-dimensional plexiglass systems that are about an inch wide, and they allow us to actually photograph the root architecture on a daily basis so that you can understand the effect of both the capping material on root growth and root architecture, as well as if you have an underlying layer of mine tailings, how that impacts the development of the root system and root architecture. These data will then, These data will then be used to develop remediation guidance for the mining industry and for regulatory agencies by allowing us to apply optimized conditions for capping materials for a wide range of mine tailings materials. So with this, I'm going to now pass the presentation on to Donna Zhang, who's going to tell you about our three biomedical projects.
Hello? You all hear me?
Yep. Yep.
So thank you all for giving me the opportunity to present our research project. And thanks, Rebecca and Reina. So I have no need to emphasize the significance of study arsenic and diabetes. So our Superfund biomedical projects are largely focused on the effects of arsenic on diabetes, in particular the role of transcription factor NRF2 in arsenic-mediated diabetes. So I have been studying NRF2 over the last 20 years. So we have found that arsenic activates NRF2 in a non-canonical manner, which is P62 dependent. So that's why you will see lots of P62 knockout cell line and MOS model in the project. And the one more thing I want to mention is, so arsenic has different forms, so different species. In the environment, it is inorganic arsenic. So we are exposed to arsenic 5. Once it gets in, it's reduced into arsenic 3. Then it is metabolized into organic arsenic, such as MMA, DMA 5, then to MMA or DMA 3. The reason I mention this is because different form of arsenic has total different toxicity. So MMA 3 is about 20-fold more toxic compared to inorganic arsenic. So you will see also lots of called speciation, basically identify different forms of arsenic. Okay, so project one led by me, we try to study the law of NF2 and T62, this non-canonical activation of NF2 in arsenic-mediated diabetes. So wild-type mice exposed to particles from Project 4, and the top one is most toxic, and the last one is the least toxic because of bioavailability. So we put those particles into food to feed mice, and arsenic in drinking water is a control. So after exposed to different time points, then we will measure arsenic concentration and speciation in blood, urine, and possible even tissues by Project 4. And also measure diabetic outcomes such as insulin intolerance, glucose intolerance test, obesity, cholesterol level, and triglyceride level. And for the 40 weeks, mouse, we will measure diabetic nephropathy. So then in AIM2, we will pick those diabetic relevant cell lines, make use CRISPR technology well established in our lab to knock out NF2, P62, and the both. The rationing is to understand the non-canonical mechanism of NF2 activation, right? So then we will analyze those omics, such as genomic, transcriptomic, proteomic, and the metabolomic. So those MEC data will be analyzed by DMEC, led by my colleague, Dr. Oi, to identify the key important genes or metabolites in controlling arsenic-mediated metabolic reprogramming. Then they will, those, the importance of those genes will be, importance of those genes will be verified in mouse model. So those models, again, have enough to knock out mice, P62 knock out mice and double knockout. Then those expression of genes and also metabolites identified in AIM2 will be verified in those tissues that are relevant to diabetes. So that is project one. Project two, led by Xinxin Ding and Qingyu Zhang. So they interested in two of the NF2 target genes, hemooxygenase 1 and the CYP2A, and they think the activation of those genes. So we already have preliminary data identified that hemooxygen 1 is highly induced by arsenic in intestine, and the CYP2A is in the liver, highly induced. So they hypothesized that through bilirubin, it protects arsenic-mediated diabetes. So again, we'll use, in AIM1, they use CYP2A knockout mouse. Then because the human counterpart is called CYP2A6, so they will put it back to generate humanized mouse model. Okay, in AIM2, has wild type, and also by crossing this flux, hemooxygenase 1, with intestine epithelium specifically, to knock out hemoxygen 1 specifically in intestine. in intestinal epithelial cell, then measure same outcome as in project one. In addition, we'll measure, of course, bevacizumab and belrubin and other metabolites, and including important metabolites identified in project one. In addition, they will measure FGF15 and FGF21. The reason is those have been reported have endocrine functions. They can lower blood glucose by enhancing glycogen storage and the glucose uptake by adipose tissues. And we also see the upregulation in those in response to arsenic exposure. And also they can, those two facts can inhibit liver bile acid synthesis. So in insulin, both unconjugated and conjugated bile acid in those tissues or feces, blood will be measured. So so our project is very well integrated. As I already mentioned, all the particles to feed the mice will be from project four, and arsenic concentration and speciation in blood, urine, and tissues will be measured by project four. And all the fecal samples from project one and two, those mouse model, will be used for project three to analyze metagenomic profile of gut microbiome. So project three mainly focused to understand the associations between the gut microbiome communities and their capacity to affect gut arsenic concentration and speciation. So M1, they will correlate the different genotype, as I show in project one and two, and also in arsenic exposure, diabetes outcome, with microbiome compositions and the arsenic concentration and speciation by profile the microbiome communities, microbiome functional genome profile, and correlate with the arsenic metabolites, so arsenic speciation. In M2, the design, they will generate a synthetic communities called syncom, so cultivating in the petri dish. So we'll pick up 220 syncoms. So this is guided, the design of syncom communities will be guided by the project one, the outcome of project one. And then we'll treat those syn communities by arsenic, then to measure arsenic speciation. So doing that to identify three types of syn communities. So one is those can sequester arsenic. The second is those can make arsenic more toxic. And the third one are those make arsenic less toxic. Okay. So then pick one from each category. Then pick one from each category, we'll test, we'll feed the mice, gene-free mice, and treat with arsenic to correlate with the diabetic outcome. Then the one that show most beneficial in reducing arsenic effect in diabetes will be used finally to test in specific passenger-free mice. So the doing this, we try to identify a synthetic community that can be developed as probiotics to produce, to reduce or alleviate negative health outcomes associated with chronic arsenic exposure. So in summary, you know, our superfund is to understand the mechanism of arsenic mediated by diabetes, and to find strategies to alleviate the adverse effects of arsenic. Thank you. Monica?
Yes, I am here. Okay, so let's see if I, there we go. All right. So my name is Monica Ramirez. I want to highlight I'm second generation Mexican-American, and I was born and raised in the U.S.-Mexico border region. I have a strong sense of place to the environment and the communities in which our program serves. And actually, my father was a miner in Arizona at one point in time. It gives me great pride that I've bared witness, it gives me great pride to be part of this program, and it's an honor to be part of it now and be under and working with the magnificent Reina and Donna, as you just previously heard from. If we look at research translation, this is something that we've been working on since 2015 with the new initiative set by NIAHS SRP. We have spent efforts to address and resolve local environmental issues, and we know that you can address these better when you engage scientists and others from various disciplines, regulatory officials, industry, and the affected community. And so we host quarterly, for as an example of this, we are hosting quarterly multi-organizational calls that bring together stakeholders from local, state, and federal and community members at the Superfund sites in which we work. We also support two community advisory boards in legacy and active rural, medically underserved mining communities to address and facilitate the dialogue and address identified concerns of community members. And so this model, our environmental research translation model, is built upon the peer-reviewed literature and is rooted in a participatory approach, transdisciplinary team, effective collaboration, and information transfer, and a cultural model of risk communication, which directly aligns with SRP's mission for translational efforts. Just to give a shout out to all our training course students, we have after formative and informal evaluation, our University of Arizona students have reported that being part of this transdisciplinary research team has increased their ability to conduct transformative work beyond their education, which is exciting to hear from students. We provide extensive training, and I just highlight that students do a local interview on their local radio, which works out nicely for them to learn how to articulate their research with a 2-minute elevator pitch. We also require, as other programs have highlighted, community engagement efforts, and they have reported the benefits of that experience, giving their research a social context that increased their motivation and understanding of their contribution to science and society. Our community engagement core is led by Dr. Carletta Chief, which ensures a community-engaged participatory research, training, education, and capacity-building approach through the development of community-engaged tools centered on solutions, a solution-based approach to indigenous food sovereignty. So we're highlighting here the major aims of the community involvement core, but I want to highlight that these efforts are means to mitigate the increased risk of diabetes. We have food sovereignty efforts in some tribal communities, but the connection to arsenic and water as a result of mining and increased risk to diabetes is lacking. And so under the leadership of Dr. Carletta Chief, they're engaging in multilateral communications with key stakeholders and supporting indigenous food sovereignty. I'll also highlight that Dr. Carletta Chief has recently dedicated substantial time and energy to address COVID-19 on Navajo Nation. Navajo Nation has one of the highest COVID-19 infection rates per capita, and our CEC efforts led by Carletta Chief are identifying direct links to environmental and individual risk factors associated with these infection rates due to this being unjust health disparity, an unjust health disparity. Our data management core, excited to be working with our what we call the DMAC. Right, they provide, as you see here, data storage and processing and sharing. They develop our predictive algorithms for all projects, which is incredibly helpful. So beyond just data and sample management, they can perform both standard and custom computational analyses. And they have established and will maintain a web application to allow researchers and community members to see the data. So this will be a user-friendly web application that will be implemented using our in-house maintained server in conjunction with our statistical environment. And so we, University of Arizona has Cybers, which is an outstanding computational infrastructure. All right, next slide. Oh, see some graphical changes here, no problem. So just highlighting combining research translation and data science. I see the time, so I'll be swift. We are looking, so Garden Roots was established in 2010 in collaboration with the community that Raina Mayer highlighted earlier, Dewey Humboldt. And more recently, based on the results of community needs assessments and ongoing community engagement in Arizona, Garden Roots was launched in new communities in 2015 and now just recently in 2019 to continue to address community concerns regarding soil, water, plant, and dust and quality as well as dust. Since the inception of Garden Roots, right, we have trained over 120 people. And so it's critical when people talk about citizen science, the core of citizen science is to ensure that the community members are generating the questions for study. And so here are examples of where the original, are my soil safe? Can I grow food? In Superior, right, is my air safe? Are there uncontrolled sources of dust in my community? And lastly, looking at ingestion and protecting children. But I will end with something that we're recently working on and really excited of looking at addressing the challenges with addressing wicked dilemmas around environmental health. And one of the biggest things is to solve these, we know that we've had public health surveillance efforts at the local, state, and federal level, and more recently have more and more citizen science efforts. One of the biggest challenges is incorporating these government data sets on top of trying to incorporate citizen science generated data. So we're asking the questions of how can we make citizen science collected data interoperable with government data sets, which will be, and then we're also continuing on with that question. What ontologies need to be made for this to occur? And so the ontologies would be allow for the interoperability of these data sets and allow for an environmental health scientist to work on different platforms. But not only are we looking at vulnerability in these areas, what about the resiliencies? So in this case, it's looking at what are the forms of formal and informal capital and structures that can positively respond and combat these environmental health insults that might lead to diabetes and obesity, and how can we mobilize them? And with that, the last is and how to visualize this new data management and interoperability efforts or the fair treatment of the citizen science and government data sets to inform where we can build and capital in these communities and how it should all be visualized. And this is thank you, and we're ready for questions, I guess.
Great. Thank you so much, Raina, Donna, and Monica. That was great. We do have time just for a few questions because we do have to start wrapping things up. But so the question that came in is, what is a synthetic community or a syncom?
So understanding is those are the microorganisms they isolated, able to grow in petri dish.
Yeah, so we have a researcher that does high throughput culturing of microbes. And so we are going to do a high throughput culturing effort on the gut microbes from these mice and identify species that affect arsenic, make it more toxic, less toxic, or sequester it. And then we can put these different microbes together in synthetic communities and inoculate them into germ-free mice.
Okay, and then our final question, and unfortunately our final, but again, if you have any more questions, feel free to put them in the Q&A pod and we'll make sure the speakers get any additional questions. But the final question is, how are the mechanistic effects of arsenic-induced diabetes separated from non-environmental, for example, diet-induced causes of diabetes within the human population?
So for our research, we basically use exactly same diet, right, to just the mouse treated with or without arsenic. But for epidemiologist study, yes, you have no way to separate arsenic with other environmental diabetal genes.
Mm-hmm.
But there's plenty of data indicating that the arsenic in human, they are urine, you can detect arsenic species in their urine. So there's a very good solid publications indicating that arsenic causes diabetic phenotype.
Okay, well, thank you so much. So we do have to conclude. But before we conclude, I just want to make sure that everyone is aware of the related URLs pod, which contains the seminar resources and seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We will place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack. So in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Also in the related URLs pod, you will find an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. And we do look at these comments as we continue to try and improve the content delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. Next slide, please. I would also like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any of our webinars. So for more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the CLUIN.org website. You can also subscribe to the monthly free e-newsletter called Tech Direct, and you can also follow CLUIN on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And we encourage you to visit the SRP Risky Learning webpage for information about upcoming sessions, and you can also follow us, the SRP, on Twitter. Next slide. So I'd like to encourage everyone to join us again on October 28th, November 9th, and November 19th for the remaining three sessions in this series. In the next session, we will hear from the University of Kentucky SRP Center, the Oregon State University SRP Center, and the Baylor College of Medicine SRP Center. If you would like to join the webinars, our registration is filling up fast, so we encourage you to register now. If you cannot attend, archives will be made available after the event, so you can come back to these pages for the links to the archives after the webinars are held. And finally, if you were not able to attend the first session, we encourage you to check out the archive, which is now available on the CLUIN website. So with that, it's time to conclude today's webinar. If you submitted an online question and we did not have time to get to it, we will pass those questions along to the presenters. If you have additional questions, you can also contact the presenters via email, and their email addresses are on the seminar homepage on CLUIN. So once again, I would sincerely like to thank our presenters and